You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 3rd of May 2024 on Monaco Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program, Xi Jinping visits Europe for the first time in 5 years. But does China or Western Europe have any real interest in reviving relations? After that, we'll get the latest business headlines and then...
We will give £3 billion every year for as long as is necessary, and we've just really emptied all we can in terms of gifting equipment and the biggest amount of equipment we've been able to give so far, and some of that is arriving today.
David Cameron of the UK promises long-term aid during a visit to Kyiv as the United States warns of chemical weapons being used by Russia in its ongoing war with Ukraine. And finally on the show...
Call me when it's done.
What is this place? Huh? You don't understand.
That is from the newly released Love Lies Bleeding. We'll get a roundup of the latest film news ahead of the weekend. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. It's been 5 years since China's President Xi Jinping set foot on European soil, and how the world has changed since then. One pandemic and one full-scale invasion later, and it's fair to say relations between Western Europe and China are a great deal frostier than they were in 2019. French President Emmanuel Macron will be hoping to change that somewhat when she visits Paris on Monday. Well, joining me to discuss this further is the founder of China Dialogue and a visiting professor at King's College London's Lao Institute, Isabel Hilton. Isabel, welcome back to the program. Let's start with what motivated this trip for Xi. Why now?
Well, there's a serendipitous bit of timing in the visit to the reminder of previous NATO excesses when the bombing of the Belgrade embassy, but that I think is coincidental. In a larger picture, his visit is, I think, connected to China's real need for investment in China, but also the ramping up of China's ambitions to remake the global order. And Europe is a pretty key piece in this. If China wishes to reduce the power of the United States, it, as ever, needs to stop Europe aligning with the United States against China. And that game has been going on for some time. And we're at a fairly kind of critical moment, more than two years into the war in Ukraine, terrible relations on the whole with Europe. But China has been trying to sort of pick off and establish strong bilateral relationships in order to stop the European Union and particularly the European Commission from ramping up its trade barriers, its much more robust security relationship, and all of those rather negative developments that China's seen in the last couple of years.
Well, Isabel, when you mention investment and China's interests there, there is maybe, let's say, a recognition that it needs more investment from the West. But I do wonder at what cost, because, of course, Europe in particular will be interested in perhaps geopolitical concessions, whether that is Ukraine and peace talks or other human rights elements. This has been part of Europe's policy in the past. It is obviously why relations are frosty with China. So what is your sense of what Xi might be willing to give up at this point in order to get a boost in investment and trade?
The signs are not particularly promising. We've had some vague expressions about possible mediation in Ukraine. There's a peace summit coming up in Switzerland, which certainly France would like China to join in, because you know there, it is quite clear that China could, if it chose to, exercise more influence over Russia than it has so far chosen to do. I'm not sure that China is really willing to do very much beyond the rhetorical. It's certainly, you know, because of the driving factors back home in the Chinese economy, you have some absolutely structural problems that are now seriously in collision. You know, the Chinese economy is over invested in its industrial sector. It's now producing goods, particularly low carbon goods, which are directly challenging the economies of Europe. And it's very hard to see that mere words are going to change any of that. And certainly Xi Jinping is not going to give it up any more than he's going to give up his close relationship with Vladimir Putin, because that's part of his rather larger strategic vision. So I don't see many meaningful concessions on the Chinese side. You might get something cosmetic, for example, the lifting of the sanctions on particularly a German think tank, Merricks, but also on EU parliamentarians. And those came down over Ukraine. And amongst other things, they sabotaged the EU-China trade and investment agreement, which had been long in the negotiation. China could lift those if it chose to, and that would certainly improve the atmosphere. But in terms of substantive concessions, it's quite hard to see what they'd be at this point.
Isabel, if we're not expecting substantial concessions, as you say there, that this is more about rhetoric, what does Emmanuel Macron expect to get out of this? He is going to be wining and dining Xi Jinping. They're going to the Pyrenees. I mean, does he imagine he has more influence here over China than he actually does?
Well, that is always a bit of a hazard with Macron. If you remember the very long table at the end of, you know, with Putin at one end and Macron at the other. I think that is a bit of a hazard. But it's also, you know, undeniable that France is attractive to China, because historically France has always maintained its distance from the United States, and it's, you know, it has its own nuclear deterrent, for example, which, unlike the British deterrent, is not dependent on the United States. And, you know, France's position of strategic autonomy, which Macron does argue within the European Union, chimes rhetorically, at least, with China's position. China has been urging Europe not to be, you know, the tool of the United States and so on and so forth. So that's a sort of opening for China. But it's countered rather in recent years by France's anxiety about its own car industry. So one of the several trade disputes or challenges that the European Commission has opened against China is one on subsidies for electric vehicles. And that was inspired by France. From the Chinese perspective, splitting France and Germany, which frankly is quite easy to do at the moment since Scholz and Macron clearly don't get on, that's another big ambition. So divide and rule is also part of China's strategy in Europe, trying to stop the rather more robust view which is coming out of Brussels from prevailing with the member states. So it's got Hungary as a spoiler, which, you know, a role that Hungary is always happy to play, and flattering Macron against Germany is another. That's another key relationship within the European Union.
Well, and Xi Jinping will be heading to Serbia and Hungary after Paris. But to follow up on that point with Germany, we are also hearing that Macron and Scholz held a private dinner ahead of this meeting with Xi Jinping. Do we really imagine that Scholz and Macron don't agree when it comes to China, that there is actually some daylight that Xi can exploit?
Well, I think that was probably the frostiest dinner on the calendar of either of them, because Scholz has just been to China with a very large business delegation. There's clearly tension between Germany and Brussels over, for example, the electric vehicle issue. And this is France's issue. So it is, in some ways, you know, you could see that they could have an aligned interest, but they really don't appear to. And I think that, you know, for example, when Macron was last in China, he made some injudicious remarks about Taiwan on the way back, which didn't please Germany. At the same time, France is closer now to Ursula von der Leyen's position than it used to be, and Scholz really did some damage to that on his very recent visit to China. so that, you know, the Franco-German relationship, which is historically the great driver of the European Union, it's not looking terribly close at the moment. I mean, clearly there are, you know, there's a massive overlap of interests in general. But on this particular issue on China, I think there's quite a lot of divergence. And for example, you know, Germany, which made the great mistake of creating strategic dependencies with Putin, which really came back to bite them when Putin launched his full-scale invasion of Ukraine. There is a sense, both in Paris and Brussels, that Germany is repeating this with China because of the pressure from big German companies that are heavily invested over a long time in China. And that really limits Scholz's room for maneuver.
Thanks very much, Isabel. That was Isabel Hilton. Now here's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Turkey has stopped all exports and imports to and from Israel, citing worsening humanitarian tragedy in the Palestinian territories. The Turkish Trade Ministry said the measures would be in place until Israel allowed an uninterrupted and sufficient flow of aid into Gaza. In 2023, the two countries had a trade volume of $6.8 billion. Britain's opposition Labour Party won a parliamentary seat in Northern England, beating the governing Conservatives. It's one of a series of votes that will help gauge public opinion ahead of a national election due this year. Rishi Sunak's Conservative Party has lost three councils and 100 councillors so far. And China has launched an unmanned spacecraft on a nearly two-month mission to retrieve rocks and soil from the far side of the moon. The Long March 5, China's largest rocket, blasted off at 5:27 p.m. Beijing time from Wenchang Space Launch Center. China is the first country to make such an ambitious attempt. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Carlotta. Time now for the latest business headlines with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts here on Monocle Radio. Ewan, thanks very much for joining us as always. We're going to start with the tech giant Apple. We have spoken about them a number of times in the past, but there's been some relief for investors.
Chris, yeah, the only story in town for global stock markets at the end of last year and into the start of this year was the rise of the Magnificent Seven, the incredible outperformance of seven big tech stocks in the US. But it's fair to say that Apple missed out on the party, along with Tesla, whose shares have fallen quite a lot. It was the only one of the Mag 7 not to see big, big gains. In fact, you'd probably call it the Fantastic Five would be rather more accurate. But a bit of shine has returned to Apple today. Shares jumping in pre-market trading in New York. The board has approved plans for an additional buyback of $110 billion of the company's stock. It's the biggest share buyback in US history. It's also posted stronger than expected sales last quarter, and it says it will return to sales growth in the current period. Now, part of the problem has been a lack of innovation of new devices from Apple. That's contributed to the slow sales. Next week, it's going to unveil new iPads, the first updates to that particular product line in 18 months or so. And sales performed better than expected in China. We've discussed this before, but China, the second most important market for Apple, was accountable for about 18% of sales. And it has been hit with a lot of competition in China and a bit of a crackdown from the government there. They've banned the use of foreign technology in some offices. So they've been struggling in China, but the numbers out of China today were rather better than many were fearing. Apple don't actually deep dive into the geographical data too much, so analysts have to do the work on this. And it looks like iPhone sales in China last year were more heavily skewed towards newer models, so that's nudged up the average selling price per unit. So that might explain why the company's unit sales have been dropping, but revenue is up. But broadly, these have been welcomed by investors. Shares currently 6% higher in pre-trade in New York.
Ewan, just to follow up on that, when you mentioned the announcement or next week unveiling of a new iPad and all of that, is there some kind of risk here when you also talk about the lack of innovation at Apple that investors are getting, you know, too excited too early and this could all come crashing down again next week?
Well, the trouble for Apple, it is an enormous company with enormous sales. It is amongst the top three most valuable companies in the world, but they are still very heavily dependent on the iPhone. So the iPad is really a bit of a sideshow, and they're trying to introduce new products as well to move away from the dominance. But still, almost half, almost 50% of sales at Apple are from the iPhone. They have been growing their services revenue. So this is when you buy things in the App Store, you make those payments, and they take a bit of a chunk of that as well. So services have been growing for Apple, and that's something they're keen to develop, but it is still very dominant on that one product. And as you probably notice if you buy an iPhone regularly, that the innovations in phone technology have started to lessen. There are only so many things you can do with technology to make it better and better. So that is a constant struggle for Apple and for other phone manufacturers.
Ewan, just one other story, if we could get from you as well. Goldman Sachs is taking advantage of new rules in the UK about bankers' bonuses.
Yeah, US investment bank Goldman Sachs is getting ready to scrap the cap on bonuses for hundreds of bankers in London. It's the first bank to take advantage of a rule change which came in 6 months ago. And you remember the bonus cap was first introduced by the European Union back in 2014. That was in response to public outcry over the financial crisis. The cap limited bonuses to twice annual salary. How effective that was, I think, is a bit of an ongoing question. There was a high-profile example from Citigroup, which awarded one London-based executive an $8 million fixed pay packet compared to the $1.5 million paid to the boss of the bank, the chief executive. And that allowed his total compensation to stay within the bonus cap rules. So a lot of banks have sort of got around this. And I think for the government in the UK, it was politically awkward for the government to change the rules on this. Most people don't have a lot of sympathy for highly paid bankers, and particularly at a time when many are struggling financially. But they did do it in October. Plenty of industry lobbying since the UK left the European Union to get rid of the cap, and it's gone now. So Goldman Sachs is taking advantage of this. And a number of other British banks are also set to vote on this at their annual meetings as well. So that cap is gradually going to be unwound here in London.
Not necessarily something everyone will be happy about. Ewan Potts, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. To Russia now, which has been accused by the United States of using a choking agent and riot control agents in Ukraine in violation of a global ban on chemical weapons. Russia has not commented on the allegations, but given that its war in Ukraine is itself a violation of international law and Vladimir Putin is wanted in the International Criminal Court for war crimes, it's hard to imagine Russia paying much attention to this accusation. Joining me now in studio is the Russia analyst and regular Monocle contributor, Stephen Diao. Good afternoon, Stephen.
Good afternoon, Chris.
Let's start with the U.S. What did the U.S. say here? When? Where is this intelligence coming from?
They're always rather limited in telling us exactly where their intelligence comes from. But they say that there is a chemical agent called chloropicrin, which was actually used in the First World War. So, you know, it's something that's been around for a very long time. But it is banned by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Tests that have been carried out on Ukrainian soldiers who've been in the trenches certainly strongly suggest that they have been poisoned with this. One soldier has died, about 500 others at least have shown signs of the effects of this gas. And of course, it is banned. The Russians have said repeatedly over the years when they've been accused of using chemical weapons, such as, for example, the poisoning of Alexei Navalny in 2020 or the use against the Skripals in Britain in Salisbury in 2018. They say, no, of course, we don't have chemical weapons. I'm afraid this is another of these Russian denials that we simply cannot believe. I was doing some work only this week looking back at the history of Berlin. And just before the Berlin Wall went up, Ulbricht, who was then the East German leader, 2 months earlier, he said, no one has any intention of building a wall. Just before the war in Ukraine started in February 2022, Putin said, we have no intention of invading Ukraine. I draw the link because what is happening now in Russia is so heavily connected with old Soviet practices and the Soviet practices, of course, which were then reflected in East Germany. And I'm afraid this is one you simply cannot believe when Russia denies something. In fact, there is the meme that goes frequently on X, Twitter, that says, don't believe anything until the Kremlin denies it. And this is another one. They're definitely using chemical weapons. There's no doubt about it.
Well, and you did mention the poisonings as well, of course, of Alexei Navalny and the scruples. But I did wonder if, denial or no denial, what we know of the past, has Russia used chemical weapons in wars in the past that they have been involved in, whether it's Syria or elsewhere? What does that tell us about whether they, frankly, have ever held to this treaty on a ban of global chemical weapons?
No one has proven that Russia used chemical weapons in Syria. We know, of course, the Russians got, from 2015, got heavily involved in Syria and went on many bombing campaigns using bunker-busting bombs, some of the most vicious of the bombs. But we also know that they were very close to the Syrian regime, and we know that the Syrian regime used chemical weapons against its own people. So there are suspicions, perhaps behind the scenes there are secret documents that show that there were greater links between the Syrians and the Russians, but the evidence suggests that the Russians have maybe just been one step away from it, but close enough for allegations to be thrown at them. And I think from the Western side, certainly to stick, that they have been involved with the use of chemical weapons elsewhere.
Well, as you mentioned, in Syria, the Syrian regime used chemical weapons. Obama famously backtracked on a red line when it came to the use of chemical weapons, which does make me, to bring it to today and this accusation from the U.S., what is the point of warning about such violations if nobody wants to really do anything about it?
Indeed. And very early on in this war, so in March 2022, President Biden said that if we get evidence that the Russians view chemical weapons, then we will do something about it. And then almost started to backtrack by saying, well, of course, it would depend on the how they were used and so on. At the moment, it seems unlikely that the Americans would actually take any further action than the one which Ukraine is very grateful and the Western world is very grateful they have taken recently with the issuing of the and allowing the $61 billion aid package to go to Ukraine. I don't think they can really tie that to the chemical weapons story, but it's very difficult to imagine how would they then... They can impose more sanctions, for example, but other than that, how would they then move against the Russians for using chemical weapons? I think sanctions in this case are the only possible option. But of course, more and more Russians and more Russian companies are being sanctioned. It comes to a point where who else do you sanction?
Absolutely. Well, one other aspect that I wanted to ask you about in Ukraine is David Cameron, the UK Foreign Secretary's visit there at the moment. He has promised $3 billion a year in aid for Ukraine long term, as long as it takes, as it were. The UK has obviously been something of a leader on Ukraine since the beginning. How much will this mean to Ukraine, do you think?
This will mean a great deal to Ukraine. From the start, when our then Prime Minister Boris Johnson went to Ukraine for the first time, one of the first Western leaders to do so, the Ukrainians really did thank Britain, and indeed we have received a number of Ukrainian refugees in this country. I'm often loath to praise our present government, but this is one thing which they have done really well, and I think it's very interesting. Cameron making this long-term promise. Very few people expect there will be a Conservative government by the end of this year. We have a general election coming up, and it's likely that the Conservatives will not get back in. But the question then is, will Labour honour it? And the talk that has come, they haven't commented about this latest promise, but the talk that has come from Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, and the Labour Party in recent months suggests that they will honour it, because they too have gone out of their way to support the government on its Ukraine policy, and they agree that we must keep supporting Ukraine. I think one of the things that really stands out from Cameron's visit is that he said that the British weaponry that's being sent to Ukraine can be used to strike targets in Russia. Now, this is a real change, because it suggests that the West is really beginning to understand who they're dealing with on the Russian side. Early on, the Americans ruled out that, and indeed the West said, you know, you mustn't, said to Ukraine, we're giving you these weapons, but you mustn't use them to strike targets in Russia. And that completely played into Putin's hands. Putin doesn't play by any rules. And of course, he's been targeting Ukraine. It's estimated that 250,000 buildings in Ukraine have been destroyed, many of them residential homes, blocks of flats, even though, of course, another lie from Putin is that they don't target civilians. Of course, they target civilians. So this idea that they're keeping the Ukrainians' hands tied, saying you can't attack targets in Russia, really just played into Putin's hands. So at least now Cameron has come out and said that. And I would expect other Western leaders. President Macron of France has been very forward-thinking in saying he's not even ruling out the idea of sending French troops into Ukraine, which gives Russia the jitters, definitely. He has said, effectively, we now know who we're dealing with. We need to deal with it with Russia in a stronger way.
A sign of things changing in Europe. Stephen Diao, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, it's time for a roundup of what's happening in the world of film. I'm joined by Ashanti Omkar, film, TV and culture critic. Ashanti, welcome back to the program. We're going to start with a release that's hitting cinemas in the UK today, a new thriller starring Kristen Stewart. We heard a bit of it at the top of the show. It sounds quite ominous.
Absolutely. You are right about it being ominous, because it starts off as this almost beautiful love story between these two women. You know, it's a reclusive gym manager, you know, and this bodybuilder comes to this gym, they fall in love, and it all seems to be, you know, going really well for them until things start to change and it gets quite gory. There's a lot of blood, there's a lot of killing. It's a typical A24 release is what I'd say. And as you mentioned it as being a thriller, and it's been labeled as a romantic thriller for a very good reason, because you start to see this new character who's come into Kristen Stewart's life, and you just start to see what she actually is. And on one hand, you're seeing this kind of sweet, loving woman, and then you start seeing what violence she can create. And Katie O'Brien really gives us a brilliant, I mean, she's got the look for it as this rising bodybuilder. You can also see, you know, you'll empathize with these characters in so many ways, which also is something that adds a layer to this, because you realize that people are just not black and white. They can be so gray.
Well, I did want to move on to one other film from A24. This one that you're talking about, Love Lies Bleeding, is out now. But A24 also has a film that is still buzzing in the cinemas, and that's Civil War. How has that been doing? It had a kind of slow start, but it's picking up.
Gosh, yes, it really has been. And this one being a very kind of a dystopian, you know, war film, Alex Garland knows how to give us this kind of movie. But what really surprised me about this movie is its longevity, and the fact that people are flocking to cinemas to see it. People are having conversations about this film, because obviously the word Civil War, some people were thinking, oh, is it going to be like a Marvel Civil War movie? But no, this is a very, very real and stark look about how humanity can turn within a second, how the dark sides of humanity are there. But it looks at how the press views them, because if you're part of the press and you're reporting on any kind of war, you're actually witnessing atrocities, but you have to capture them with your camera, your video camera. You have to write about them, but you can't intervene. You know, you're not allowed to actually intervene. That is the protocol. And this is what this, you know, I even talking about it to you right now, I have goosebumps thinking about it, because I have a friend who's a photographer who's been on these war zones. And I always think, gosh, you know, their lives are at stake. At the same time, they can't actually intervene when something horrible and horrific is happening in front of them.
Yeah, absolutely, Ashanti. I've seen this too, and I did have those similar goosebumps. I did wonder from that perspective too, just this is not necessarily to say how the film was sold originally. It sounded like it would be more of this political thriller, especially in the space of, you know, Trump and Biden and everything that's been happening in the United States. Do you think that's a reason why maybe it's taken some time to gather steam, as it were? People were expecting something else. Now that they know what it is, maybe they're going to go see it because it is a film about the press and photography.
Absolutely. I feel like in the early days, a lot of people didn't even get what this film was about. People who saw the film were tweeting about it, saying, oh, gosh, I didn't really get it. What was the point of this film? But I think it's a slow burner. It's stuck with people. People are realizing, with so many wars around us all the time, people are realizing that there's so many layers to these wars. And it's actually drawing people in and getting people conversing about it. And I think it's that discussion that makes this film so special.
Now, one other thing we wanted to talk about, the British institution that is Doctor Who. It is obviously huge here, so long running, and there is a new Doctor Who.
Yes, there is indeed. My gosh, the Scottish actor Shruti Gatwa is taking on the mantle of Doctor Who. And he's already given us, you know, the transfer has happened between him and David Tennant. He's already given us a taster during the holidays, the Christmas holidays. And we saw what he can be and what he can give us as the 15th Doctor. And this new incarnation, you know, we know he's an alien, he's a Time Lord. He travels through space and he's got a TARDIS. But this time he's got Millie Gibson coming together with him as Ruby Sunday. And we have been promised a very special series indeed, because there are some new characters that have been very, you know, they've been teased to us already. So we are waiting with bated breath as to what they will do. There are actual episodes that have been teased to us as being something that's been in the showrunner's head for like 40, 50 years. And they can come to life now that we've got the technology to bring those to life. So it's going to be a very, very exciting series indeed. And I simply cannot wait.
Well, and just finally, Ashanti, speaking of things that many people probably cannot wait for, The Lion King, there is a prequel coming out. Mufasa, what can you tell us about that?
Oh, gosh, this time round, Barry Jenkins, who has, you know, he is from the Oscar-winning, should I say, Moonlight, you know, him coming together with the team of The Lion King was something I never, you know, assumed would happen. This is really surprising. It's a photorealistic animated prequel. It's got Beyoncé's daughter, Blue Ivy Carter, whom we've seen, you know, so many times with her mother on tour with her on the Renaissance tour. She's actually making her debut, her film debut, which is beautiful. As a brilliant set of people giving these voices to these characters we all know and love. But we are seeing what happened to Mufasa before The Lion King that we know and love. Donald Glover, Seth Rogen, Beyoncé herself coming together, Aaron Pierre, Kevin Harrison Jr., they're all coming together. Mads Mikkelsen, I could just, the names are just coming out of my head like, wow. And it is going to be very exciting. With the technology we have today, I think we're going to get something that looks so real, like we'll be transported into those jungles of Africa.
Just quick follow-up on that, Ashanti. Do we imagine this will be successful? Is there sometimes a risk with Disney's efforts to remake these?
There is a risk. This one is coming to us this Christmas, as almost a Christmas present. I feel like the family audience will flock to see this. They've timed this very well from a marketing standpoint. And I do think that this will work, because we've seen prequels working. You don't think of them as being something so important to the cinema world, but now they are.
That was Ashanti Omkar. Thank you very much for joining us. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Have a good weekend, everyone. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.